Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Artifacts and documents are the concrete clues that cultures leave behind to tell a story. A gateway into the past, filling in details. If those artifacts disappear or are destroyed, the nuanced understanding of a society could evaporate. Here to tell us about a dramatic rescue of artifacts, saving them from imminent destruction, is the director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland, Marvin Pinkert. The museum's newest exhibit, Discovery and Recovery, Preserving Iraqi Jewish Heritage, features centuries-old artifacts that detail communal life, religious practices, and eventual persecution of Jews in Iraq. The show is presented in partnership with the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration. Welcome, Marvin Pinkert.
Thank you for having me, Sheila.
Give us the background of this exhibit. Where does the story begin?
Well, you know, the story, you could say, begins with the Jewish experience in Babylon, which is over 2,500 years ago. But the story of this particular exhibit begins more recently. In May of 2003, when there was the beginning of the invasion of Iraq, the secret police headquarters was bombed, and the lower level of the building was flooded. And the rumor went out that in the flood, there was a 7th century Talmud that had been confiscated by the secret police, which would be amazing because no such thing was believed to have existed. This is a Jewish book. Mm-hmm. And so a team was sent in. The same team that was looking for weapons of mass destruction went in to see if they could find the Talmud. And what they found was that the lower level contents of the building were in 4 feet of water, and that it looked like it was all just a mess. It was going to never be able to be recovered. They took everything that had been bombed and flooded, and they put it out on the front lawn to dry. But this is Iraq, and it's the middle of summer, and it's the heat is a real issue.
The heat because of the mold that would form.
And so that's the point at which the National Archives gets a call to come and rescue the records.
And before I ask you what happened, at that point, what were these materials floating around in this water?
Well, the building of the secret police headquarters, one of Saddam's palaces, had been divided into rooms by nationality for intelligence. So there was a U.S. room, a France room, a Britain room. And at the lowest level, there were two rooms, one for Israel and one for the Jewish community. And it is unclear exactly how these materials came to be held in that room. But those materials from those two rooms were what they found floating because they were at the lowest level of the building.
So this stuff is waterlogged, spread out on the lawn to dry in the sun, and the U.S. Archives gets the call.
Gets a call and says, what do we do? And the head of preservation, Doris Hamburg, responds.
At the archives.
At the archives. Says what you really need to do is to freeze them because that will prevent the spread of the mildew. But this is the middle of war, and finding a refrigerator truck and enough fuel to power it was a major international undertaking. People were involved from all over to try to hold on to the records. But all that did was preserve soggy things in a frozen state. What needed to be done was the records needed to come to a facility which was in Texas, where they were freeze-dried. The water was taken out of the trunks that they were brought in. And they were, in effect, desiccated records. And then they could be brought to the archives where they were restored. The mold was removed. The records were mended. Where there were holes in the paper, fill was applied. And so...
But I'm still hung up on... We're in Baghdad. It's hot. They find a freezer truck. They load all of these
about 2,700 pieces.
And they're still wet at this point, I imagine.
Yes, they are.
2,700 pieces.
Right.
They manage to somehow get this truck still freezing away.
Right.
Onto a ship and back to.
Well, actually, they are able to move the truck to a airplane hangar where they take the trunks, and I'm not exactly sure how they managed to keep them frozen on the airplane, but they came over by plane from Iraq.
And went to Texas.
And went to Texas, where in a facility that was rented by the archives, they were able to freeze-dry the records and then later on to bring them back to the facility in College Park where they were restored.
And restored there as opposed to being restored in Iraq because of
I don't think that there in 2003 you would have found a facility left standing in Iraq that could have done this work.
And then I interrupted you. You were telling us some of what went into the preservation.
We have photos and examples in the exhibit of the records in the state that they were in when they came freeze-dried to the archives. And they are, you couldn't believe that anyone could make out anything that was on those pages. They're just a mass of material. And they had to be placed in water, the layers of dirt that came off the records, they used mold remover to blow away the mold that was on the freeze-dried records. They unfolded them carefully and looked for where the cracks were in the records, mended the cracks where they could. And they just did a beautiful job so that in the end, some of these records look like you could read them. And I refer to them as records because I have to confess, I used to work for the National Archives. So for me, everything feels like a record. But some of these books, manuscripts, etc., look like they were written yesterday and not that they weren't 500 years old and had gone through a war.
And were they able to do that for everything that
came? Not absolutely everything. I think that there may have been as many as 3,500 pieces in the group. 2,700 were treated, and there are also fragments of things that couldn't be dealt with. And especially there were fragments of Torah scrolls that they found. And by Jewish law, Torah scrolls that are not whole need to be buried as you would bury a human. And so there was a ceremony held in New York where the Torah scrolls were, in fact, buried, all except one small sample, because none of them had survived intact.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Marvin Pinkert, director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland, about the new exhibit, Discovery and Recovery, Preserving Iraqi Jewish Heritage. So what do visitors see in this exhibit? What are the highlights?
The highlights are, first of all, 23 original pieces that came through the process I'm describing. Most of these are, as I say, books and letters and other pieces of paper. There's also, however, a teak, a Torah holder made of wood and glass that they were able to restore. There is material from going from the 16th century up to about 1973, which is the year that the last Hebrew print work was done in Iraq. And it comes from the entire globe. There are original pieces from Italy, from Austria, because if you were to go into someone's closet and ask what's in the closet, and you didn't ask, well, what do you have that's native to your local area, you'd find that you'd have materials from all over, that the Jewish community is connected. And so there are materials that were printed in Italy for the purpose of serving the Jewish community in the Arab world. And you'll see a lot of that in the exhibit. You'll also see the actual process that was used to restore the records. There's video of the work that was done on saving the records.
What do we learn about the history of Jews in Iraq?
I think that you learn that it's not only a long and deep history, which there's the Babylonian Talmud, there is, which was an authoritative voice in Jewish life for centuries. There's schools of scholarship that existed in the Middle Ages in Iraq. But you also learn that the community, to many people's surprise, was actually thriving in the 19th and 20th century. There are materials here from the period when a quarter of Baghdad was Jewish.
An
estimated 50,000 of the 200,000 people who lived in Baghdad in 1910 were Jewish. And in all of Iraq, there were still 130,000 Jews in the period before World War II. So it's an amazing story of what was once a very vibrant community, and you learn something about how that community fell apart through the records that are there.
And that falling apart then was mostly in the 20th century?
It was mostly in the period from the rise of the Nazis onward. There was briefly a pro-Nazi regime that lasted only a few weeks in Baghdad, but they managed to do a fair amount of damage to relations between the Arab and Jewish communities. And they, I think, killed something like 180 people, but they also did a lot of propaganda that persisted through the war period and then became more intense in 1947 as the Arab world became more concerned about the creation of the Jewish state.
And then
there is a major airlift in from 1951 to 1953 in which thousands of Iraqi Jews make their way to Israel primarily, but America as well.
How many Jews are in Iraq now?
I've heard three numbers, 2, 3, and 5.
A handful.
Right.
These items were in the basement of Saddam Hussein's intelligence headquarters because however many Jews were left in Iraq while he was in power were suspect?
You know, there are different versions of the story here, and I don't know which one is correct. There are versions that people, as they left, simply left behind materials and that the police went around and collected them, as they became refugees. There are other pieces which undoubtedly were confiscated from active family households, etc. But in the end, there are things that were found in the basement that have absolutely no intelligence value that you can imagine. There were 60 copies of a child's primer in Hebrew. I can see doing many things with that, but intelligence, probably not.
These materials that have been restored, they're being digitized, or they have been?
They were all digitized, and they're in fact available at a special website, which is called IJA, Iraqi Jewish Archives.
We will link to that from our website.
Yes.
So
the entirety of everything that was restored has been digitized and is available worldwide.
And so this exhibit has been in several cities.
This is the sixth venue. The exhibit is part of the provision that was made when these documents came to the United States, is that the United States, through the aegis of the State Department and the National Archives, would be able to put these on display for a brief period of time. That brief period of time has now been extended twice, and what was supposed to be 6 months in the United States has now been over 5 years, and we are the sixth venue. It's been in D.C., New York, Miami, Kansas City, and Southern California.
And from Baltimore it goes to
the Bremen Museum in Atlanta.
And then eventually back to Iraq.
That is the what's on paper, yes.
You sound skeptical.
All I know is that it was supposed to go back after 6 months, and it's still on the road. I think, I frequently am asked about the question of, well, what do you think about these records going back to Iraq? And my answer has to be, 45 years ago, I was working for the State Department, and I might have given you an answer then. And 6 years ago, I was working for the National Archives, and I might have given you a different answer then. Now I'm working for a museum, and from my museum perspective, what's interesting to me is that though the records are available digitally to anyone anywhere, there is still such concern about where the physical copies end up. And that tells me that museums still matter. And so my encouraging note from all this is that it is an example of the fact that we all do still care about the authentic originals. And as long as people care about authentic originals, museums are in great shape.
In addition to the exhibit itself, are there some events?
Yes, we've got a full set of programs. We have some of the people who were refugees from Iraq coming to speak, Morris Shokat, who has his photos of his bar mitzvah in Baghdad and his wedding in Baghdad are in the exhibit.
That's going to be on October 29th,
That's
right?
That's right.
Sunday at 1 p.m.
And then on December 3rd, we have a major event, Talmud Atik, which is our Iraqi cultural festival. We'll have performers there from the dance troupe. We'll have a chance to make your own date balls. So there'll be a tasting part of the event. We're bringing in a group from D.C. that is specializes in teaching people how to read Judeo-Arabic, and so, which was the common language of the community. And so it's going to be a lot of fun, a very hands-on experience. And then we just worked out an arrangement where Henry Green, Dr. Henry Green, who runs the website Sephardi Voices, is going to come near Martin Luther King Day to come speak about the experience of the Jews of the Arab world in a manner parallel. He's trying to record their stories as the Shoah Foundation has recorded the stories of Holocaust survivors in Europe, because in this case, the community still exists. The Iraqi Jewish community doesn't exist in Iraq, but it isn't as though they were all killed. They exist in many parts of the world, and the survival of that community and the documentation of that survival is an important part of this story.
And the exhibit itself is up through January 15th.
Yes, January 15th.
Thank you for telling us about it.
You're most welcome.
Marvin Pinkert is director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland. The exhibit Discovery and Recovery, Preserving Iraqi Jewish Heritage, is up through January 15th. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to the exhibit and a video about the restoration process. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. After a break, a Stoop story.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.